Welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's part clipping service, part information center, and it's all about Hawaii. This month's launch of the state's new geospatial data portal offers information sets for state agencies and the public. It also has a few featured apps spotlighting issues, including the response to homelessness and a vaccine finder. It's the picture of Hawaii the state wants to be publicly seen. Arthur Butto is the Geographic Information System Program Manager within the Office of Planning, and he's with us now. Hello there.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure. Looking through all of this, it reminds me in some ways of sort of the, you know, the top line of old Britannica, you know, encyclopedia types where you have, you know, a heading and then there are a little bit more about it. But it's, in a way, you know, the nice story about it. How do people actually get into some of the data that they might want to see and check out? And is everything available that, for example, a state agency would see?
Almost everything is available that a state agency would see. So I should mention that the GeoPortal is one part of our overall GeoPlatform. Our GeoPlatform includes things like the portal, but also for state agency users, it would include software to analyze that data, pull in data from other sources, and other online tools that state users can use. The difference with the portal is that it's a public-facing vehicle for getting the data out to the public. In the past, we've had a website with a download for data. It's mostly of interest to GIS professionals, the GIS community. The difference here is that this data is available, and you can view it in a map right online, right through the portal, or you can download it in multiple formats, or if you're a coder, you can pull that data into your into the app that you're developing.
Which is to say that it has a lot of marketing application to it.
Our point is to get the data out there. You know, the states, the agencies are collecting this data, and they've been using it, but it's public data, so it's available to anyone to use, and that's part of the reason for the portal is to make it available out there. And one of the things we wanted hear from the public is how they're using the data, or if it's useful to them, and if it's not, what would be useful to them, or how are they using it?
You're a data guy, and you like all of that. And looking at and seeing all of these data sets obviously pleases you greatly in seeing the launch of the portal. But are there things that might be difficult to have out there, or that maybe should be looked at once or twice over to see whether those data sets should be there?
Even before it gets to the portal, it goes through some vetting at the agency. So the agencies are constrained by statute. There are also things like FERPA for the DOE and HIPAA for Department of Health, and they're very careful about PII. So there's some data personally identifiable information.
Like, for example, who owns what piece of land?
Yes. Or your Social Security number or your driver's license number. So there's data that may get to us, but the agencies have asked us to not release to the public, so we'll strip out that data before we put it on the portal or make it available even to other agencies. So there's some restrictions that we have on data, and we get some data from the counties that they may not want to share generally, but they'll share for a particular state project or for a particular agency's use. So there's some data that we have that's not on the portal, but for the most part, 80-90% of the data that state agencies use is on the portal.
For example, if someone wanted to be sure that the ownership of a particular parcel of land, and that's one of the categories that you can search, isn't there, so what I understand from you is that would be removed before I would ever get to it through the portal.
That's right. That's correct. And if they send us an email asking us about that, or they call us and ask us about that, and we do get those calls, we'll just direct them to the county real property. Often the county's websites will have that information, but on an individual parcel basis rather than the entire data set.
And what about for large parcels, something that might be owned by a corporation?
We do aggregate some data. So we've collected data from all the counties, including ownership, and we've set thresholds on that, and we say if statewide a particular owner owns more than this many acres, we'll put their data on our large landowner data set. So those data sets are on our portal as well.
What's that threshold?
I think it's 500 acres. I'm not 100% sure.
At this point, for people who are going in and starting to look at it, because it's pretty new, at least the launch of it in the last week, what have you heard?
Well, we've only heard from a few people because it is very new. I've had one person that said they love it. And that was a person in our office, so that was a little biased. And one person that said she had some difficulty navigating it, but once she figured it out, she was interested in the data that she saw. And that's sort of what we want to hear, is we want to hear how, you know, where the difficulties were and what would be useful for them to see.
Does it matter how you are viewing it on what device? And I ask that because as I was looking at it on, you know, my desktop was one thing, and then when I was trying to look at it on my phone and swiping and you know, tapping it to go back and do other things, that sometimes it would get stuck.
It should not matter, other than it's going to look different on your phone. It automatically reorganizes itself based on the device. But the functionality, that would be an issue, so we'd like to hear that.
But in terms of the messaging, because very clearly when you read through it, and if you look, for example, under the app for homelessness, there's a very clear narrative. It's not super long, but it's very much in the interest of the state. And there are some, you know, jumps or gaps in information because it's not meant to be a news story and it shouldn't be confused with that.
It's not meant to be in-depth. It's not meant to be an in-depth analysis. So there are a couple things that are on the portal. One is the data. So you can just look at parcel data, or you can just look at census data, or there's another section that has these featured applications, and they might contain a story, a particular story that an agency wants to tell. These are developed by other agencies, not necessarily our office, but it tells a particular story they want to tell based on the data that they have or the message that they want to get across, or it could be an aggregation of data that is commonly asked of this agency, so they've put it out on a map that the public can access.
More than just FAQ stuff.
Yes. So there's actual data. If you look at some of those maps, like the census, you'll see socioeconomic data.
Bottom line, you just have to know what you're going in and looking at, whether you're looking at raw data or whether you're looking at a narrative that's meant to convey a certain perspective.
Yeah, and for us, this is sort of our second go at this, but there's a lot of potential for this kind of platform, putting more apps up there, maybe categorizing apps, maybe just making. And again, we're looking for user feedback.
So you'll see if there's going to be most likely a third go and a fourth go, and
there will be
continual iterations of it. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Arthur Butto is the Geographic Information Systems Program Manager within the State Office of Planning. That's attached to the Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism. The Hawaii Statewide GIS Program is the linchpin for a dozen other Hawaii government agencies that develop and maintain geospatial data, maps, and applications, many of which you can see. And if you'd like to have a look, you can check out our Facebook page. That's now The Conversation-Hawaii Public Radio.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a story of hope in the midst of the Holocaust. But first, your backyard quiz.
Ka ho'olawe, o Hawaii. In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about one of the more colorful inhabitants of the Hawaiian Islands. Like many of its fellow occupants, this creature is graceful at sea, clumsy on land, and has particular difficulty with takeoffs and landings. Once in flight, though, it's something to see, especially when it's diving deep below the ocean surface for squid or schooling fish that are its prey. This bird is about 28 inches in length with a wingspan of more than 36 inches and either white or brown plumage. Its most distinctive features are its petal extremities, webbed and bright in color. Those are the features that give it its name. It breeds on islands in most tropical oceans, but it's been known to stray far from its regular habitat. In September of 2016, a male of the species was found washed up on a beach in East Sussex in the British Isles, 5,000 miles from home, and no one knows why. But if you saw this bird, you'd know why it has a somewhat unflattering name, and that's the name we're looking for today. And as you're listening to the rebroadcast of the conversation, we won't be taking any calls to answer the backyard quiz, but you can always call us at 11 a.m. when we're live.
All your pedal extremities are colossal. To me, you look just like a fossil. You got me walking, talking, and squawking. 'Cause your feet too big, yeah.
Aloha, I am Ron Branville from Easter Seals, Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It's axiomatic in the worldwide Jewish community that the Holocaust should never be forgotten, both as evidence of man's inhumanity to man and for its memories of the heroism of a few. One of the heroic memories is the Kinder Transport, the effort in the months leading up to the Second World War to rescue German Jewish children from the death camps. It's being remembered in a memorial service this Sunday at Honolulu's Temple Emmanuel, and Dennis Saleh, Honorary Consul for Germany in Hawaii, is on hand to tell us more. Thanks for coming in, Dennis.
Aloha, Chris.
It's amazing. We were talking about this a little while ago, that there are so many stories of the Second World War era that have yet to emerge in popular understanding.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, as a German born and raised and having grown up in Germany, I often feel like I'm coming out of a semi-unconsciousness. I really, as I grow older, come across so many more stories and facets of the Holocaust and those terrible years. And it's equally fascinating as it is gruesome to learn about these things. And the Kinder Transports is not really an episode that's unknown, but it really only started gaining public awareness around 2000, you know, in that time. Mm-hmm. Although the facts were all there and the story was there, but I think people try to target, the issues by importance, maybe, you know, or by magnitude first.
Well, magnitude, yeah.
And so Kinder Transports is in that, you know, order of magnitude, maybe one of the smaller stories, but nevertheless an incredible episode.
Well, let's elaborate what it was. I mean, basically that there were people who saw what was coming and rescued how many kids?
Well, in total, 10 to 11,000. Mm-hmm. 10,000 went to England, about 1,000 went to the U.S.
And it's one of the more ignoble memories of the U.S. that we actually banned the entry of Jews to America in the years leading up to the Second World War.
I think that is probably an episode that the U.S. needs to deal with a lot more than they have.
Yeah.
I think not for me to comment on, but in this particular context of the kinder transports, the numbers speak for themselves. The British government made a very quick decision in 1938, right after Kristallnacht, mm-hmm. to let in these children and without any ado, really.
Yeah.
Whereas for a child or a family to make it to the U.S. took a lot of bureaucratic hurdles to overcome, you know, in the midst of drama, really. And it didn't happen in a lot of times.
Well, you mentioned in terms of the U.S. coming to terms with its history, modern Germany has done a great deal of coming to terms with its history and been pretty candid about acknowledging the horrors of not that many years ago.
Yes. You know, I was born in 67. Mm-hmm. That was a time when I think Germany was just starting to really be candid about their history. It took them 20 to 30 years to come to that point. Mm-hmm. But once they did, they really unpacked, and they're still unpacking. To this day.
And there's healing to be had from doing that, isn't there, Dennis?
Yes. I think, you know, for the German people, for sure, mm-hmm. this is the only way to come out of this, is to be candid and to try and speak about it in the most plain terms and to look at every aspect. But it also, you know, serves as a lesson for humankind as a whole. It's really not just a German issue, what went on. And I think the Germans are doing a fairly decent job in trying to put history in perspective.
There's been a smug assumption on the part of the people of a great many different countries that it could not happen here, that it was some sort of flaw in a specifically German national character that Nazism was allowed to happen. And I think that perception is breaking down. I think it's more likely to see it as a flaw in human character that something like this can happen.
I think you're probably right about that. And for a long time, the look of the Nazi movement was isolated as a German problem. Mm-hmm. Also in the light that Germany had two world wars to justify.
Yeah.
And so the second one was sort of proof that there's something in the pudding for the Germans, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think what we've been seeing since is that the idea of racial superiority, putting people outside of society for particular reasons is not just a German problem.
Yeah.
That happens in other parts of the world all the time to this day.
There's something tempting about it to people wanting to, you know, if you can exclude others, people seem to think that you elevate yourself. I think that's a fallacy, but it's something that attracts people, isn't it?
I think in times of great uncertainty, it's more likely for that to happen than when everything works just fine.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other things that have to be in place for this kind of sentiment to really take hold in society.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a person usually at the top that tries to very planfully instigate this type of division in society. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't just come by society's will, you know, by accident. This is typically done with somebody at the head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, you've got to learn those lessons of history, don't you, Dennis?
Yeah, you do. It's very exciting, actually.
We ignore them at our peril. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Dennis Sala, Honorary Consul for Germany and Hawaii, will take part in a Yom HaShoah Holocaust Remembrance Community Service this Sunday at Honolulu's Temple Emmanuel.
Support for today's programming comes from the 36th Annual Maui Classical Music Festival, with concerts in Makawao, Makena, and Hana, May 5th through the 12th. Tickets and information at mauiclassicalmusicfestival.org.
The fight to undermine protections of the Papahānaumokuakea Marine National Monument are escalating, or is escalating. Civil Beat reporter Nathan Eagle has today's reality check. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, but apparently not so well for Papahānaumokuakea. We talked in past about what the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council has been saying about it, but now it seems they've been joined by American Samoa and Guam and the Northern Marianas. Why?
That's correct. It comes back to commercial fishing interests again. All three of the territories you just mentioned, with support from Westpac, are interested in trying to help these fishermen regain access to these places that they've lost access to when the monuments were created.
At this point, what do you know of the veracity of what they are saying? Is it really true? Because we've been having a lot of discussion about whether, for some of the assertions we've heard from Westpac, whether those are true or not regarding fishing.
Right. It's complicated. You talk to Westpac and some of the territories, and they're going to point out that, a little over half of all the places that they were able to fish at before in the U.S. Exclusive Economic Zone, that's the area that extends about 200 miles from the shorelines, has been lost once these monuments have been created. But when you then talk to other folks and then look at the fish that actually are being caught, they're having no trouble at all finding fish in the ocean to catch. And in fact, they're actually on track for another record year.
Of being able to get quota even earlier in the year?
Exactly.
We also saw some of the response from our own congressional delegation. How is that setting up another fight with what many would want to see President Trump do?
Well, I see the commercial fishing interests, these territories and Westpac being emboldened perhaps by President Trump administration compared to the previous one under Obama. Our U.S. Senator, Brian Schatz, thinks that, they don't stand a very good chance at undoing any of these protections and points at how historically that's been next to impossible. But this is a whole new time and a whole new era with Trump.
That said, are you seeing any real movements against the letter that we saw put out by Westpac and others?
I am. There's been a coalition of groups, environmental groups, Native Hawaiian groups, others that have kind of banded together to push back against this.
And what's the next step? Where is the next signpost anyway?
I don't see anything on the calendar, but I do see this fight continuing. I think it's going to be a flurry of more letters back and forth from each side. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Westpac's upcoming meetings are again protested by some of these same environmental groups. So I just continue to see it escalating.
Yeah, because we've talked to Earth Justice and seen, obviously, Sierra Club is a signatory on this too, and other groups that we've talked to. And if this is just going to go back and forth and back and forth, some would say the longer that happens, the better the chances for something potentially not happening with Papahānaumokuakea that those groups would see as being really dangerous.
That's true. I agree.
All right. Well, we'll see how this continues to go. And thanks very much for the story.
Thanks again.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Nathan Eagle. In recent months, the assault case of Peyton Valiente has refocused attention on how cases like this one are investigated. In 2015, he was the toddler physically abused at a daycare, and his case has only recently come to public light. One issue seems to be clear. Best investigation practices weren't followed, including talking to the other children at the daycare. An agency that could have helped in that process is the Children's Justice Center. Carrie Ock is the Hawaii chapter coordinator. We sat down recently to talk about best practices in abuse cases where kids are concerned.
I'm glad you said best practices, because we are very proud of the system that does get involved when best practices are followed. So that would be the Children's Justice Centers would be contacted. Any child where there's a concern of abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, they would be allowed to come to the Children's Justice Center and talk about what may have happened to them. So it's a very child-centered, child-friendly approach children are able to speak with someone who is specifically trained in how to talk to children. They don't have to necessarily go to a scary police station or something like that. It's a community response that helps support for the best possible outcomes of an investigation and to kind of lower any of those anxiety levels a child might have about talking about what happened.
In this case, we're talking about a toddler and one who was injured. So you're really talking more about the other children who might have observed something that happened to this child, a place for them to be able to talk and a way in which to gather information.
Yes, exactly. So Children's Justice Centers, there are five across the islands, and this is a national model. And usually children as young as the age of 2 years old are able to be what we call interviewed at a center like this. So it's not really an official, you know, interview interrogation, but it's a conversation, like I said, with someone trained how to speak with children that young. It could be the child who has received injuries if they're able to talk, or it could be witnesses to a crime or to abuse like that.
When we talk about children, there are different age groups that come to mind. You were talking now about very young children. Mm. It could be maybe kids who are in the single digits. But what happens when they start to be in the, say, middle school and high school years? Are you still talking about putting them in a program like this, or at what age does this become not the best practice?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So nationally, it is known as best practice to have a child, and I say child, I'm meaning adolescents as well. So anyone under the age of 18 could benefit from this model, where they're able to come to a center that is cozy and warm and private. For the little kids, there's games and toys. For the older kids, there's more, you know, age-appropriate activities or books and things like that. They are able to speak one-on-one, and the older kids handle that, you know, usually a lot better. They speak one-on-one with that special kind of interviewer as well. But they don't have to go from person to person. Like in an abuse investigation, you might imagine, there's a number of different agencies that need to get involved. So the idea of a justice center is that the child doesn't have to first talk to the social worker, then go talk to the police officer, then go talk to the doctor, then go talk to their lawyer, and things like that. It's a way to coordinate all that information gathering at one place, and it really lowers any additional possible trauma that a child or adolescent might feel just as a part of the investigation itself. So we don't want to re-traumatize kids in our quest to find out what happened.
The care for a child is clearly coming through the way you've described the process. But there's also the question of how do you get at the truth? Sometimes children perceive things so differently. Often they perceive them so differently. Mm-hmm. And when they can, in some cases, be wrong. Mm-hmm. If you interview them one time, some people might be thinking, well, how then can you make sure that this story is what's kind of, you know, either the truth or sticking, or maybe just because it's sticking, does it make it the truth?
Mm-hmm.
How do you go and approach all of that when you're talking about a child?
Mm-hmm. Great question. This type of interview is called a forensic interview, and it's not, of course, like a magic wand where we're able to know automatically, of course, this is exactly the truth of what happened. Many children are very accurate historians. I kind of want to address, like, a lot of people ask that question, and I think that where that question comes from, a lot of people don't want to really believe that horrible things can happen to our children. And so I think it's easier to maybe think like, oh, the child misunderstood, or maybe they're making it up to get back at someone. But we do find that that is a rarity. I do want to say that when a child makes an allegation of serious abuse, sexual abuse, serious physical abuse, research has shown, I mean, it's very rare for them to be outright kind of making it up.
What does rare mean? Are we talking about you know, 10% of the time, or what? Give us some sort of sense of what that means.
Sure.
Words are sometimes difficult to quantify unless we've got some numbers to put behind them.
Sure. So with studies that I've read take it from between 1 to 8%. And I think that variation is there because it can be hard if a case is not proven beyond a reasonable doubt or to a certain level where they can take charges at least, it may be classified as not necessarily false, but it may be looked at as false. When not necessarily it's not a false allegation, it just wasn't proved. So I think there's a little bit of a variation there in that 1 to 8%. But national studies, I have found that. And this seems quite low to me.
How many cases do the Children's Justice Centers across Hawaii see on an annual basis?
You know, it varies. So Oahu sees the most, clearly, and then there are centers on Kauai, Maui, and two on the Big Island, so East Hawaii and West Hawaii.
In terms of the process of getting to a Children's Justice Center, what does that process look like?
Sometimes parents or community members will call the Justice Centers directly and kind of want services. The way a child is able to receive services is that they must be referred by law enforcement or by child protection. So the Justice Centers need to know that these concerns, these allegations have come through the proper reporting channels. And so the referral would come directly from the investigating agencies.
Right. So they're not just conjecture on the part of somebody who may care deeply about a child and is looking at you as being the agency to go and investigate it.
That's right. That's right. So we are not the investigators. We help coordinate the investigations and bring everyone together to be able to do that.
As you look at where we are now in protecting children and of what you know of other centers like yours across the nation, where would you put Hawaii? How well do we actually protect kids?
I think we do a very good job. I think that it is one of the hardest jobs, absolutely, to be able to receive a concern from someone, a teacher, a neighbor, be able to go out, investigate, make the right call. Do we pursue this farther or do we not? I do know that of the calls that have come to child protection, there is about a 40% kind of confirmation rate, I guess, where they say, yes, something did happen here. And I think that is appropriately significant, you know, a significant rate where they are able to pursue it and to find that, yes, this child needs assistance and something really happened here.
Has there been a case where you would have liked to move through it better and that there might have been a better outcome if you had been involved, aside from the Peyton Valiente case that we talked about in the beginning of our conversation, but where you think that it would have truly made a difference?
What we do know is that child abuse is underreported in general. So I know there are a lot of quote-unquote, you know, cases or incidents of abuse that I'm confident we could have helped, the Children's Justice Centers could have helped. I don't know that I could speak to one right now. I know that it's not just in the investigation part that the Justice Centers and the friends of the Children's Justice Centers can help, because they're also doing a wraparound service. They're making sure that those children get mental health, they get medical care, which can be very physically and emotionally helpful, you know, treatment-wise.
During your tenure, you've seen a number of kids come through at all ages.
Hmm.
Do you have a sense of how many are of the younger ones, how many older ones come through your program who actually take that step of moving through with law enforcement?
Mm-hmm. So that middle school age is the most, that those are the more the kids that the Justice Centers see.
So 10 to 13-ish?
yes, kind of that 8, I would say 8 to 13. Mm-hmm.
And just to wrap all of this up, as some people may be hearing about the Children's Justice Centers for the very first time, and as you've already said, hey, we don't take calls from the public if you're concerned about this. Mm-hmm. What would you ask people to do in just knowing about you?
Mm-hmm. So if anyone has any kinds of concerns, I would really urge any adult to call their local law enforcement to report or to call child welfare, child protection. You would not be calling the Children's Justice Centers directly because it has to go through those proper channels. There are people who are specifically set up to take these kinds of reports and to be able to send folks out on an initial investigation. So important for adults in children's lives to be able to speak up when they fear that something is wrong.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Carrie Ogg is the chapter coordinator for the Hawaii State Chapter of Children's Justice Centers. She's been in that position since October of last year. She previously worked as a forensic interviewer at child advocacy centers in Colorado and Oregon.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet, also what we can look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. We've got him on the line now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be back. So this week, Stargazers, look out for Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in our island skies after sunset. Mars will be setting early in the west around 9 p.m., but Jupiter and Saturn can be seen all the way through till the early morning. The moon this week will be waning, meaning a return to dark skies here in the islands, perfect for stargazing.
Now, you've got an update on a big story that relates to one of the planets that you were just mentioning.
Yeah, and specifically, it's the ringed planet Saturn and its icy moon Enceladus. For almost two decades, the Cassini spacecraft has been touring the Saturn system and performing the most detailed studies in history of Saturn, its system of rings, and its moons. The latest batch of data to have been analyzed by scientists here on the Earth may indicate that the moon Enceladus may very well be suitable for life.
Now, this may not be a huge surprise to folks if they've checked out stories relating to the topic in the news, and certainly we've been talking about this at different points on Stargazer. So what is this latest development that's got people excited?
Well, Cassini has performed some daredevil dives into the geysers erupting from beneath the icy surface of the moon. And in some cases, it's gotten to within 30 miles of the moon's surface. That's about the distance from Hilo to Volcano National Park. What Cassini found was evidence of molecular hydrogen, H2, which is a key energy source for many organisms in the oceans of our own Earth.
So this might be a source for energy in an ocean under Enceladus.
Absolutely, that's the theory. And this new data that's just been obtained has given that theory a huge boost in credibility.
And as we've previously reported on Stargazer, time's running out for Cassini, right? Mission is going to end soon with a big plunge.
Oh yeah, it is indeed. Unfortunately, Cassini's epic voyage is almost over, and it is set to go out with a bang. We will be covering the final dramatic flight of Cassini as it flies through Saturn's rings and ends its mission in a fiery plunge into Saturn's atmosphere later on in the year.
And maybe even learning some more new stuff like today as we progress on that journey. Appreciate the report. Thank you so much, Christopher Phillips.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about a part-time resident of the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, a seabird that breeds on land but spends most of its life at sea. It feeds on small fish or squid that gather in groups near the surface and is capable of diving deep to catch its prey. Breeding pairs stay together for years, with males and females taking turns caring for eggs, which are laid one at a time. They've got a colorful mating dance in which the male sky points, aiming his beak straight upward. Because they have no natural predators on the nesting islands, they show no fear of humans. Their naivete is the likely reason for their name, believed to derive from the Spanish word for stupid. There's another part of their name, though, inspired by its colorful feet. In Latin, it's Sula Sula, but in English, it's the red-footed booby.
And Walter Wright knew that, called us from Honolulu. And yeah, I agree with you. They got the raw deal. They're delightful
birds. Very much
birds.
So, yeah.
That's today's quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, an online tool designed for parents to strengthen the school-home connection by creating continuity between classwork and homework. Achieve3000.com.
It takes no more than a glance to recognize a happy family, and Kauai's Kekua Aloha Foundation is sponsoring a photo contest to capture those images called What Does Ohana Look Like? Kaylin Drake is the coordinator of that contest, and she's on the line. Hi, Kaylin. Thanks for talking with us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
I imagine you're getting some pretty interesting submissions to this contest, yeah?
Yes. There's a lot of submissions from families.
I think I just lost you, Kaylin.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, stay real close to the phone, yeah, so we can hear your voice coming through on the radio. But this is it's a very nice idea. Did you come up with this idea?
Yes, I did.
And what kind of photographs are you seeing?
Many families, they're either hiking at the beach. Just spending time with the family.
Lots of outdoor activity among the family members, yeah?
Yes.
Well, what kind of things do you see? You know, how can you tell when you see a photograph like this? What are the things that you look for that sort of makes you know that it's an ohana that you're seeing?
Well, just looking at their faces and them enjoying each other. That's what ohana to me personally is. Just being together as a family is important. So just them looking like they're having fun or, you know, enjoying themselves as a family.
What kind of things do you do with your family?
Well, my family, we like to have dinners, like barbecue, or we would dance and sing karaoke.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Lots of things.
Yeah.
Do you have a kind of a large ohana there on Kauai?
We do, and we love spending time together, so.
What different generations have you got?
We have my grandparents, my parents, and me and my brothers.
And how old are you, Kaylin?
I am 15 years old.
And this, you know, you must have done a lot of work to get all this organized.
Yes, it's kind of stressful, but a lot of work has been put into this.
Were you the judge of the photographs?
Actually, no. We're gonna have a People's Choice Award, so mm-hmm. At our Kiki Fun Baby event, there's gonna be. Whoever is there can vote for their favorite picture.
Oh, so the winners haven't entirely been picked yet?
No, not yet.
Well, that'll be kind of exciting, and that's this Saturday, huh?
Yes.
What other kind of things are they doing at this Keiki Fun Day?
Well, there is going to be a fitness course, so anybody who is wanting to do it can show off their fitness skills. There's also going to be great entertainment from Kapa'a Middle School's choir and ukulele. There's going to be some dancers coming and Zumba. And there's also going to be raffle tickets and some giveaways as well.
Kaylin, it sounds as if somebody did an awful lot of work to get this organized.
Yeah.
I see what you mean by saying it's kind of stressful. Did you have plenty of help?
Mainly just me and my family. And we've had a lot of help from sponsors from all over Kauai and the state. So.
That's pretty nice, isn't it? How long have you been working on it?
Well, this is my second annual, so I've been working from last year for this event.
So you started when you were what, just 14 years old? You've got this event going?
Yes.
Well, that's kind of impressive, Caleb. A lot of kids your age don't try to organize large-scale events like this. Have you learned a lot from the work you've done on it?
Oh, yes.
I imagine. You're going to keep it going in future years?
Yes.
I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm planning on it.
Good. Well, is that the kind of thing you want to do with your life, do you think? Kind of bringing people together and getting them to think about family, things like that?
Of course. It's really important to me.
And where did you say you lived on Kauai?
On Ahola.
So I know you said that a lot of the photographs you're seeing are families having fun outdoors. I would think that growing up on Kauai would be a pretty nice opportunity to do a lot of things like that.
Oh, yes.
So you kind of get to see what life in Hawaii is like for families. Do you have some favorites among the photographs? You don't have to give anything away, but just give me a sort of a general description of the things that you've seen in some of these pictures.
Well, there's this one photo that they're hiking, and the slogan for the photo contest is "Ohana means family, and family means no one gets left behind or forgotten." From Liloan State.
Family means. I'm sorry. Say that again, Kaylin. Ohana means family, and what?
And family means no one gets left behind or forgotten.
Uh-huh.
And this family, they dressed up as Lilo and Stitch on their hike.
They get dressed up as what?
They dressed up as Lilo and Stitch.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So that's kind of a cute picture. What other pictures you come to mind?
There is one, they're at the beach, and they're like, in the water, just spending a good time on the beach.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You know, because people have these, carry around these cameras all the time with their cell phones, you're seeing a lot more people able to take pictures like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Kaylin, it sounds like something really nice that you've done with this, so keep up the good work, okay?
Thank you so much.
Thanks for talking with us. Kaylin Drake is the coordinator of the What Does Ohana Look Like photo contest, which is part of the second annual Free Keiki Fun Day and Fitness Challenge this Saturday at Kauai's Kapa'a Beach Park from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. This is the point in our program when we look at activities going on throughout the state and activities you might not necessarily have heard of. Our Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us at this point for a look at events going on in our community under the radar. Thanks for joining us, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome, Chris.
And we have a panel discussion on a very troubling subject starting out. That's at UH Hilo.
Yes, it's on human trafficking. This is a free discussion focusing on the ethical and political issues associated with human trafficking. And the participants will be Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, Dale Ross, the first deputy prosecuting attorney of Hawaii County, and also Dr. Celia Bardwell Jones, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Chair of the Gender and Women's Studies Program. This event is free and open to the public. A light refreshments will be served. It's happening at UH Hilo UCB 100, and it starts at 5:15 tomorrow, and it's free. Free.
It's an important subject, isn't it, Derek?
Yes, it is.
And, you know, sugar has sort of gone under in Hawaii, but there was a time when sugar was king on Hawaii Island. In fact, all over the island.
Oh, yes. From the 1850s to the 1990s, big sugar plantations dominated the landscape, especially on the Big Island. The Edmund Olson Trust Archive is home to an amazing collection of maps and records and documents from these plantations, and it traces an important part of Hawaii's history. John Cross of the Olson Trust will lead a visual journey through these historic resources and the era that was known as Big Sugar. It's in the Kilauea Visitor Center Auditorium at 7 p.m. tomorrow, and it's free with admission.
Yeah, and you know, whether we know it or not, sugar has affected all of us here in Hawaii.
Oh, yes,
one
definitely.
Way or another. Mm-hmm. And there's a book club in Kona.
They will hold their monthly meeting tomorrow. The Friends of the Libraries Kona Book Club meets on the lanai of the Kailua Kona Library at 11 a.m. tomorrow. And this month's selection is called Death Comes to the Fair. And you can also meet the author. Catherine Lloyd is her name, and she's a Big Island resident who will be in attendance at this book club, and that's in the Kailua Kona Library at 11 a.m. tomorrow.
So often when you read a book, you wish you could talk to the author.
I know.
This is a terrific opportunity.
This is happening tomorrow.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, now accepting applications for summer school featuring camps on drone photography and filmmaking for girls and boys in preschool through grade 12. SacredHearts.org.
And that does it for this Monday, but we promise we'll be back with you tomorrow. And we're going to talk about the March for Science. Dr. Mark Hickson will be here. Also, we're going to take a look at the clean transportation target goal. That's in HB 1580, if you've been following that. Jeff Michalina of Blue Planet Foundation will join us.
And a photographer brings back detailed images of Afghanistan and Nepal.
If you want to see anything that we've been talking about or check out other things, you can take a look at our archive at hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you missed any of the show or want to pass one, you can find them under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you here tomorrow for more of The Conversation.